The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's January 26, 2026 edition. It's the first Time publication of this year. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. It says, "The Longevity Issue, What to Expect When You Expect to Live Longer," by Alice Park. The cover also features ascending to descending, the new old age. Time itself is in large block capital letters in white, superimposed upon a bright blue background. What's interesting about this caption of the new old age is that it looks like birthday cake. Each of the letters is in white with a confetti topping, and it's outlined, each letter is outlined in pink. So it's very festive. And on the top of THE, which is the top layer, it's sort of a four-layer cake, but not really, are candles. So there are four candles burning brightly atop Time, the word, magazine on the front cover. Okay, the first article is from Society. The heading, "Learning to Fall in Roller Derby Taught Me How to Be Me," by Margot Fisher. Fisher is the author of Leave It on the Track. In 2018, hoping that the moodiness of the trees and mountains might help me discover something about myself, I left Columbus, Ohio for Portland, Oregon. Sometimes I biked to work, and on the first warm day of the year noticed a warehouse by the bike path had its doors open. There was an oval-shaped track inside where a handful of people on roller skates were running into each other. I slowed my bike and stopped, putting one foot down to watch them. I figured it was roller derby. I had, of course, watched Whip It shortly after realizing I was gay, but I had never seen the real thing. The people in the warehouse were of all sizes, all ability levels, and they were hitting each other hard. I signed up. Roller derby is played in increments called jams. Each team fields five skaters per jam, four blockers, and one jammer. The jammer is the only skater on each team who can score points. When the jam begins, the jammers fight through the pack of blockers, then race each other around the track, earning a point for every opposing blocker they pass with their hips. The first thing they teach you is how to fall safely, because it is not a question of if you will fall. I got used to palm-sized bruises on my arms and legs, quads so sore I could not walk down the stairs. I was immediately drawn to jamming. The position is masochistically addicting. The struggle of fighting through the pack over and over and over feels worth it in the one moment you break free. I had never been athletic growing up, but I was fast and small, and learned derby is one of the only sports where any body type can play and find an advantage. I learned how to dodge larger skaters, how to duck under their hips to avoid a hit, how to jump over their legs in the turns. I started making friends. I let my armpit hair grow out and learned my moon and rising signs. I got my septum pierced and started wearing color again. I fell in love, then out of love, then in love again. I felt like I was rapidly changing, but at the same time, rapidly coming home to myself. I came out as lesbian to my mom fast over the phone, trying to make it sound nonchalant. When my parents visited 2 months later, she cried at brunch, not because I was gay, but because she was worried she'd said or done something that made me feel like I could not be. I pulled up the hood of my hoodie and yanked the string so tight I could not see her. I was lucky to have parents who voted blue and went to Pride, but they were seeing me, really seeing me, for the first time, and I hated the vulnerability. Roller derby requires you to be vulnerable. You fall a lot. You probably look awkward on skates. You make stupid mistakes during scrimmages that land you in the penalty box. I was frustrated by how hard it was because I loved it so much. I never thought about quitting. Even as it got harder and my personal life got messy, I started to crave that vulnerability. Before roller derby, I'd always wished I could just skip coming out. It was too much attention, too many people feeling sorry for me. The person I was coming out to never seemed to know how to react, which made me feel even weirder. But roller derby rewards struggle and vulnerability. You push an impossible, unmoving wall for 2 minutes, and everyone sees you fail. But the next day you come back stronger. You get knocked out of bounds a million times in one scrimmage, your whole team watching. Then next week, you're cleaner on the lines. Derby does not let you skip steps, but it does reward you for taking them. Off skates, I saw the other people in my league allowing themselves to be human with each other and themselves, and I realized this was the how I had been searching for all the way back in Ohio. This was how they celebrated their queerness. I started doing it too. The word lesbian does not scare me anymore. I write queer books. My friends and I poke fun at the Portland queer housing posts that discriminate against Capricorns. When my girlfriend and I see two other women holding hands in public, we nod at them in solidarity, because we are all part of this community that feels vibrant and safe and messy and like coming home all at once. Through derby, I let coming out be a celebration. It was not the only thing about me, but it was one of them, and I loved it about myself. Turning the page to the article that was captioned on the cover of this magazine, Longevity, the new old age, the golden years are getting an upgrade, by Alice Park. No further caption here. Okay, here we go. Life once followed a familiar pattern. You would go to school, get a job, build a family, then sometime in your 60s retire, enjoying life for a few years until you grew too frail to live on your own. Then you might move in with family or check into a facility where you would spend your golden years. A crucial part of that blueprint was an unsaid but universal assumption that for the vast majority of people, life would not extend far beyond their 70s. That was based on the average lifespan, when this still dominant picture of an American life arc was first formed, and it underpinned everything, from how people planned their careers to the way companies designed their pension plans. Yet now it looks like a relic. Today, life expectancy in the U.S. stands at 79 years, compared with 68 in 1950. The upshot, 60 million Americans are now 65 or older, which is roughly equal to the combined populations of Spain and Portugal. A similar trend is playing out globally, with an estimated 2.1 billion people, or 1 in 5, projected to be 60 or older by 2050. Already a third of all people in Japan are in that older age range. 60 more countries are expected to hit that ratio in the next 25 years. More than a century's worth of scientific and social progress means most of us are now more productive and more useful to society for far longer than in the past. What we have is a fundamental change in the age structure of society, says John Rowe, professor of health policy and aging at Columbia University's Aging Center, referring to the way we are aging and also the way we are creating young people, with birth rates plummeting in most countries. Globally, fertility levels have dropped below the so-called population replacement rate of just over 2 births per woman. It is a sea change, and one that raises big questions about how we both individually and collectively navigate what, in a sense, is our new old age. How, for example, should we spend our extra time? Should employment still be confined to a finite number of years, or instead ebb and flow throughout an entire lifetime? And where in a world of acute housing shortages will everyone live? We have to re-engineer our society, because the fundamental institutions of our society, education and work and retirement, are not designed to support a population with the age distribution we're going to have, says Rowe, who chaired the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Successful Aging. We need a fundamental redesign. Rowe is one of a growing global cohort of experts trying to work out precisely how this reengineering might unfold. And they're starting by reframing seniors not as a burden, but as untapped sources of talent, experience, and social glue. It also means thinking more creatively and flexibly about life's three-piece jigsaw, so it no longer has to follow the familiar trajectory of learning, work, and retirement. Instead, learning and work are sprinkled throughout a lifetime, rather than confined, respectively, to the beginning and middle. Periods of leisure, meanwhile, no longer need to be relegated to the end. The three-stage life is over, says Martha Devey, Associate Director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. And the quickest way to restructure it, she argues, is to stretch out education. Learning, the new thinking goes, should take place continuously throughout life, not just during childhood and young adulthood. But doing so requires more than welcoming the odd 80 or 90-year-old to audit a college course. To truly redesign education, seniors must become an integral part of a university's social and academic ecosystem. One such effort is currently unfolding at Arizona State University, home to the first university-based retirement community in the U.S., where seniors live on campus in a 20-story building that's a blend of a senior living facility and a dorm. The facility, called Mirabella, has independent living, assisted living, and skilled nursing options, like in most retirement communities. But residents are an active part of the university community, taking classes, mentoring students, and serving as teaching assistants. Everyone benefits. Professors give lectures at the residence, and several doctoral music students live in the building rent-free. Teaching seniors and gaining performance experience by giving concerts several times a week. We get to practice our craft and receive feedback in real time, says Caleb Bailey, a doctoral student in guitar performance, who is one of four artists in residence at Mirabella. Bailey and his classmates also benefited from having Mirabella residents in their classes. Two retired nurses took a musicology course on the history of arts and health with Bailey, for example. They were able to provide a wealth of information that even the professor was not able to add, he says. Dr. Richard Kramer, a retired professor of gastroenterology at Stanford University, moved to Mirabella with his wife in 2021 and was inspired to create a mentorship program for pre-med students. He and other retired doctors in the building meet regularly with students to answer questions about topics that might not be covered in the traditional pre-med curriculum, like how to achieve work-life balance, avoid burnout, navigate the bioethics challenges they may face as providers. I've always felt that the best job I could ever have is one that I wanted to do, but was not necessarily paid to do, says Kramer. That's what this is to me. It's probably the most gratifying and satisfying thing I have ever done. Students get just as much out of it. Every single time I leave my apartment, I'm greeted by 300-plus people who are happy to see me, engage in conversation, who've lived a fruitful life and have years, decades of wisdom and stories to share, says Bailey. Recent studies show that loneliness and isolation are hitting older and younger populations the hardest, and university faculty are not necessarily equipped or expected to manage social and emotional education of their students. The senior citizens on campus are helping provide that support, says Lindsay Beagley, Senior Director of Lifelong University Engagement at Arizona State University Enterprise Partners. Universities were the engines behind innovations in medicine and public health, so college campuses should be particularly well positioned to think about how to connect generations more meaningfully, she says. About 100 senior facilities are located on campuses in 30 states, from the University of Florida to Stanford. The challenge now is to entice more universities to follow Mirabella's more comprehensive model. Already the positive feedback from seniors and students is drawing attention from real estate developers, who've also been responding to the growing demand for non-institutional, non-traditional senior living options. One developer, Varsity, plans to open a facility near Texas A&M that will give seniors access to classes, sporting events, and facilities. Varsity is planning a similar community at Purdue. The current practice of retiring after a certain age mostly comes from industries rooted in manual labor and the limits of keeping older employees in physically demanding jobs. But even though the nature of work and the makeup of the labor force have shifted dramatically, most companies still think when workers approach so-called retirement age, it's time to go. But labor and social science experts say if companies want to be competitive, they should start focusing on retaining their older employees, not showing them the door. In Japan, older people outnumber younger ones, and companies have struggled to figure out what to do once seniors reach retirement age and how to entice younger employees to join and remain loyal. Some companies have found a clever solution. Rather than cutting off retirees, corporate giants like Hitachi and Mitsubishi, among others, allow them to continue coming into the office for light work, or simply to read the newspaper or socialize with other workers, called the Madogi wa Zoku, meaning window tribe, because they often sit by the office windows. These workers are proof to the whole company that management acknowledges the service employees have devoted throughout their career. The company also retains the experience these seniors have amassed, which they can pass on to younger employees. It might seem like a waste of salaries, but the idea is that investing in older workers will pay off if younger workers feel they will be offered the same treatment at retirement age. A person's career does not have to follow a straight line either. Today's jobs can be performed for far longer, rendering the traditional model of working full-time for decades and retiring obsolete, says David Rakoff, co-director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. He and other experts believe workers should flow in and out of the workforce, spending some years working full-time and some years with flexible hours to allow them to raise children, care for aging parents, or pursue other interests. You no longer need to work 50 to 60 hours a week to benefit the company, says Rakoff. You could work 20 hours if you want. Some companies are helping older workers transition into different types of work better suited to their later career needs and skills, such as tasks that rely on deep networks of contacts or more mature decision-making abilities. It is a model the government in Singapore is promoting by providing grants and payments to companies that employ older workers and encouraging seniors to pick up new skills and jobs. However, incentives like these are still relatively rare. Research shows older workers are not offered enough skill-building opportunities or schedule flexibility. 4 in 10 companies globally still enforce a mandatory retirement age, according to AARP, and 53% of executives do not include age in their diversity policies. There's a ton of conversation about what we might need to do to reskill America and upskill people, but thinking about that in life course terms almost never happens, says Stevens. This is the frontier. As the older population continues to expand, the need to adopt more of these strategies will only grow more urgent. After all, disparities in the most obvious factor in longevity, health, are already separating those who are able to age well from those who cannot. In the U.S., Rowe says the lower portion of the middle class will face the biggest hurdles in older age, as they are set to enter old age with a lower level of physical fitness than their parents' generation boasted, he says. It's 25% to 30% of the population that we're leaving behind. Making sure that longer life, and an enjoyably longer life at that, is a possibility for all, will require more deliberate intervention from policymakers, as well as a continued push to think about the life course, not in terms of chronological age, but as a continuum. And it requires a shift away from the ageist attitudes that have led to segregation and discrimination of older people. We know what to do in many, many ways, says Irving. The frustration is that we do not do it quickly enough and effectively enough. And that goes to the bigger question of our values and priorities, which have brought us to where we are today, but which can change to bring us to a different future. The previous article was slightly abridged. Here's a photo, not quite half a page, more like a third of a page. It's very dark. It appears to be at night because the background is black. There are a few lights shining from a house. But almost front and center, we see a tree trunk and what looks like a wooden cross in front of it, possibly homemade. Surrounding that centering factor are flowers, lots of flowers, roses, other things I can't identify, maybe mums, a few candles intermingled with the flowers. Around that centering aspect, that is the tree trunk, the cross, the flowers and the candles, stand many people. They're all dressed for winter weather with jackets, and some are wearing caps like ski caps. It looks like a mixture of men and women of varying ages. Some are wearing masks like the anti-flu masks. I'll read the caption next. It says, Minneapolis mourns a memorial for Renee Nicole Good, near where she was shot and killed by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE agent in Minneapolis, January 7. As federal officials argue the shooting was in self-defense, local leaders challenge that claim, citing video of the event. Mayor Jacob Frey called for ICE to end its operation in the city. The second item on this page is also small. The bulletin, U.S. Election Contests to Watch in 2026, by Rebecca Schneid, last year provided some hope for a bruised Democratic Party looking for a way forward. Following off-season election victories, November 4, the party may look to take advantage of public frustration with the economic policies of a Republican Party that controls the executive and legislative branches of government. Heading into the midterms, all 435 districts in the House of Representatives and 33 seats in the U.S. Senate are up for election. Here are the key races to watch. Governor, President Donald Trump has cut federal support for diversity, health care, climate, and LGBTQ plus rights. But states can make their own laws, so gubernatorial races loom especially large. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is running for re-election in Arizona, which has become a battleground state in the Trump era. In California, Democrats vying for term-limited Governor Gavin Newsom's seat include Eric Swalwell, Tom Steyer, and Katie Porter. Senate candidates in the Democratic primary for Senate in Maine are jostling to challenge Republican Susan Collins. The state, which voted for former Vice President Kamala Harris in the 2024 presidential election, is seen as a viable pickup opportunity for Democrats in the Senate midterms. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, former Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, has thrown his hat into the ring for the seat being vacated by Republican Tom Tillis. House. The thin Republican majority is whittled further by the 25 GOP incumbents who are not running versus 19 Democrats. In Arizona, Republican David Schweikert is vacating competitive District 1 to run for governor. Democrats also see an opportunity in New York, where Republican Mike Lawler holds a pivotal suburban district he first won in 2022. Meanwhile, the sudden death of California Republican Representative Doug LaMalfa, January 6, narrowed Republican control of the House to 218-213 and will result in a special election. The brief news. Good question. How clean is airplane air, really? By Alice Park, who also wrote our opening article. Every time you cram into a tightly packed plane, you might find yourself wondering if you're about to catch something from the person sitting next to you or a few rows away. You are not alone. Researchers are also curious about what is lurking in airplane air. Erica Hartman, associate professor of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University, and her colleagues tried to find out by testing face masks worn by passengers on flights to document what kinds of bugs they trapped. The team was also interested in the air circulating in hospitals, another public place where germs commonly spread, and tested face masks worn by hospital personnel. Researchers collected 53 masks in sterile bags and cut out the outer layers to analyze just the microbes circulating in the air, then extracted and analyzed DNA from them. To ensure they were detecting all the microbial DNA present, they also used an amplification process called PCR to enrich what was present on the masks. Overall, the air wasn't too bad, they reported recently in the journal Microbiome. They detected 407 total microbial species from both the plane and hospital settings, with similar populations of bugs from each. The vast majority of these came from skin and are harmless, says Hartman. This is not surprising, because a lot of the microbes in buildings and in the air around us reflect us, she says. A lot of the surfaces we touch tend to have skin-associated bugs because we are transferring bugs every time we touch something. We shed microbes everywhere we go. I and my colleagues refer to it as a microbial aura. The kits that the team used to extract the genetic material from the microbes were designed to collect DNA. So that meant the researchers primarily captured bacteria, not viruses, many of which have RNA as their genetic base, including COVID and influenza. While people might be more concerned about how much virus is floating around a confined space like an aircraft cabin, Hartman says viruses likely make up a smaller proportion of microbes in the air than bacteria, since people shed more skin bacteria than virus particles. She notes viruses tend to heavily depend on the right habitat in order to thrive. And once outside the body and away from cells that they can infect, they can become slightly less virulent. Although viruses do survive on surfaces, and studies show that it takes only a small amount of virus to infect someone and make them sick, the results of the study highlight the importance of developing better ways to monitor the air for disease-causing pathogens, including viruses, using filtration and sensing systems that could provide more real-time readings. Imagine something like a carbon monoxide sensor or a gas alarm that, depending on the levels of microbes present, could automatically increase air exchange rates or alert people to put on masks, says Hartman. Factoring in health and having the capability to make informed decisions about how to protect yourself would be amazing. Till then, Hartman hopes people will remember, as the weather gets colder and more gatherings happen indoors, the air, even in tight places like a plane or hospital, may not be as full of disease-causing germs as we think. Still, if you are worried about getting sick, face masks are an effective way to protect yourself from pathogens that might be circulating in the air, as well as protecting you from spreading germs to others if you are ill. Turning to the milestones page, or rather that would be pages. It's a page and a column. I'll start first with overhauled. There are three columns here by Miranda Jayaratnam. Vaccine advice for U.S. children. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, overseen by Health and Human Services Secretary and noted vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr., January 5 endorsed fewer routinely recommended vaccinations for all children. The CDC still recommends all children be vaccinated for chickenpox, tetanus, diphtheria, whooping cough, polio, pneumococcal infections, HIV, measles, mumps, and rubella. But the new schedule recommends one dose of the HPV shot rather than two, and endorses immunizations for RSV only for high-risk groups. In the biggest change, decisions about immunizations for rotavirus, COVID, flu, meningococcal disease, and hepatitis A and B are now meant to be left up to parents and doctors. While no vaccines were taken off the schedule entirely, and all will still be available and covered by the Affordable Care Act and other federal insurance programs, many physicians were concerned that vaccination rates will likely fall as a result. Going down to the bottom of the page where there are five entries, these are the small thumbnail sketches, inaugurated Zohran Mamdani as mayor of New York City, January 1. The election of the 34-year-old Democratic Socialist stunned the political establishment. Announced, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette will publish its final edition this spring by its owners, January 7, because of financial pressures. Opened a Palestinian embassy in London, January 5. The ambassador to the UK, Hussam Zomlot, called it a historic moment. Ended Minnesota Governor Tim Walz's bid for a third term, January 5. He cited the politics around fraud charges involving Somali residents. Killed 40 people after a fire spread through a bar on New Year's Day in Switzerland. Some 115 people were injured. The last two items are columns. They both deal with people who have died. First, Brigitte Bardot. Iconic provocateur. There's a photo of her. It's like a little school photo size photo with this article. She just, we see only her face, her neck, and her shoulders. In the photo, she just looks tiny. She looks so petite. She has blonde hair, and it's piled on her head, on the top of her head, with a few little spit curl things falling beneath her ears. From the style, I'm guessing it's from the 60s, perhaps. She has bright brown eyes. She has her lips are pink, and they're just in kind of a smooch formation, a little bit of a circular smooch foundation, and we see a couple of her teeth. The shoulders are bare, but at the edge of the photo, beneath the shoulders, is a white garment, and that's all we see of her. Veronique Greenwood writes this. Some months before her death, Brigitte Bardot declared war. The actress, who leaped to global stardom as a nubile rebel in the 1956 film And God Created Woman, wanted the French government to outlaw hunting with hounds. It was a move characteristic of the latter half of her life, during which the plight of animals was often in focus. Her foundation, Brigitte Bardot, has been running shelters, sterilization and adoption campaigns, and conservation efforts since 1986. In a post on ex-French President Emmanuel Macron, wrote that Bardot, famous for encapsulating a new kind of female sexual emancipation, embodied a life of freedom. She touched us. Bardot, whose death at 91 was announced December 28, was also a supporter of far-right politics in France. Decrying Muslim immigration in public letters and in books, she was repeatedly convicted of inciting racial hatred. Decades after her films first provoked scandal and fascination, she remained a study in contrasts. And the last entry in Milestones, another died column. This is by Stephanie Zakarik, and it's Rob Reiner, model of showbiz generosity. There's a photo here. It's in black and white. Reiner is on the set of North in 1994. Well, he's surrounded by cameras and other contraptions and a few people, but he's standing amidst them and pointing at something. Reiner's partially bald. He has slightly longish hair in the back and facial hair. In this photo, it appears to be salt and pepper gray and white. The unifying thread through the films of Rob Reiner is a tempered sweetness, a kind of resilient exultation informed by the knowledge that little in life ever goes as planned. That would be a glistening legacy for any filmmaker, and Reiner, who was found dead December 14, along with his wife, producer Michelle Singer Reiner, has left us with that and more. Reiner has always felt somehow like a person we knew. As an actor, particularly in his role as the adamantly liberal-minded Michael Stivic on the 1970s American sitcom All in the Family, his timing was always both nonchalant and on point. Because of his feature directorial debut, the enduring 1984 mock rock documentary, This is Spinal Tap, everyone knows what These Go to 11 means. Reiner's 1989 When Harry Met Sally, about two people who had been knocked around a bit by life, finding their way to romance by becoming friends first, gently tweaked romantic comedy conventions, and his gloriously cracked fairy tale, The Princess Bride, 1987, is pure breezy pleasure. Reiner built a career making the kind of mainstream, popular entertainments that barely exist anymore, pictures like The Bucket List, 2007, and the Stephen King adaptation Misery, 1990. His reach extended even further through the production company he co-founded in 1987, Castle Rock Entertainment, which brought us films from Richard Linklater and Christopher Guest, among many others, as well as the King adaptations, The Shawshank Redemption and Dolores Claiborne. Reiner's final feature as a director was Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues, a sequel that's more endearing and reflective than it is laugh-out-loud funny. Though maybe, as an unwitting swan song, it's pretty much perfect. If you're going to bother with anything, writing or making a film, shaping a character, pulling funding together so someone else can make a movie, you may as well turn it up to 11. Reiner did nothing by half measures. The brief business. This is one page. The Companies That Define America by Charlotte Hugh. That's H-U. In 250 years, the U.S. has become both an economic powerhouse and an incubator of globally relevant companies. To paint a picture of that business legacy, Time and Statista conducted a nationally representative survey to rank the 250 American companies that are not only commercially successful, but also have most shaped culture and society. America was branded as this special place. There was a story around welcoming people to this beautiful country to realize their dreams, says Americus Reed, professor of marketing at the University of Pennsylvania. The mechanics of this is that when you invite the brightest and best to come to one place, you get this bastion of creativity. You get innovation. You see that infused in the brands, the products, services, organizations that start here. Ford, which tops the list, has long aligned its brand with the American identity. Known for making cars accessible to the masses, Ford transformed manufacturing and transportation for the average American, reshaping the development of cities. Just as my great-grandfather put the world on wheels to give people the freedom of movement, our approach to the modern era is rooted in that same spirit. Innovation is not just about building batteries or technology for its own sake. It's about making people's lives better, says Executive Chairman Bill Ford. We're leveraging our position as the largest hourly auto employer in the U.S. to ensure the future of transportation is built by American workers for everyday American families. Companies like McDonald's, number six, that built domestic loyalty by meeting lifestyle demands of diners, are viewed abroad as cultural embassies, exports of American reliability, consistency, efficiency, and accessibility. It's not only a metaphor. In 2019, Austria made it possible for Americans to call the U.S. consulate from any McDonald's location in the country. McDonald's international locations have since evolved into destinations in and of themselves, recently documented by photographer Gary He in McAtlas. While our roots are American, it's our local franchisees, suppliers, and crew members who make McDonald's a trusted neighbor in thousands of communities worldwide every day, says McDonald's Global Chief Impact Officer John Banner. Disney, number 11. A media and experiential giant, also delivers a slice of American culture to the world. For over a century, Disney's been woven into the American story, with beloved characters and timeless tales that have brought magic, joy, and wonder to generations, says CEO Bob Iger. Walt Disney's enduring vision for this great company remains our inspiration, shaping the creativity, curiosity, and innovation that fuel our storytelling today. Some legacy brands, like John Deere, number 55, one of the oldest on the list, have maintained manufacturing strongholds stateside, even as others globalize. We've been defined by one mission, supporting the people who provide the food, fuel, and infrastructure we all rely on, and that is farmers and contractors across America, says John Deere's VP of Global Brand Management, Mara Downing. We are proud to have helped build America over the past two centuries, and we look forward to continuing to invest in our presence in America. Today, even amid political turmoil around immigration, the country's resilient entrepreneurial spirit fosters new generations of trailblazer companies like Apple, number 2, and Google, number 9, which have democratized once complex technologies while racing toward the next wave of breakthroughs. Time has published the first 20 in its list of 250 American companies, America's most iconic companies. I'll read through this list of 20 quickly. It goes from 1 to 20, so starting with 1. It will be the company name and the founding year. 1, Ford Motor Company, 1903. 2, Apple, 1976. 3, Coca-Cola Company, 1892. 4, Walmart, 1962. 5, Amazon, 1994. 6, McDonald's, 1940. 7, General Motors, GM, 1908. 8, Microsoft, 1975. 9, Google, 1998. 10, Nike, 1964. 11, Walt Disney Company, 1923. 12, PepsiCo, 1965. 13, Oracle, 1977. 14, Hershey Company, 1894. 15, OpenAI, 2015. 16, Cisco, 1984. 17, Dairy Queen, 1940. 18, Costco, 1983. 19, Chick-fil-A, 1967. 20, Etsy, 2005. Lightbox features photographs. These are all in color, titled Venezuela Aftermath. U.S. Special Forces abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores in Caracas January 3. The raid involved more than 150 U.S. aircraft and followed months of strikes on alleged drug boats and a blockade of Venezuelan oil shipments. 2 days later, Maduro pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking charges in a Manhattan courtroom. The first photograph is captioned, "What residents described as damage from the U.S. operation in the coastal city of La Guaira, January 4. There's a man in the foreground. He's holding a huge water jug. Oh, he's dressed like it's warm weather there, white shirt and longish shorts in blue and gold. What he's looking at is rubble. It looks like a multi-story housing structure, and the front of it's gone. There are doorways on the interior that you can see, and some interior walls, and just the rest of it's just rubble inside and out. And the next page is going to feature a couple more photographs. These are motorcyclists zooming through the street because the picture's blurry. Armed men on motorcycles in Caracas, January 4, the day after U.S. troops captured Maduro in the capital. Another photograph, a bright blue day. A mob of people in the streets, just a lot of people crowded in the streets. Again, they're all wearing summery attire, summer weather attire. Tall buildings in the background that appear to be intact, one or two trees also. Many of the people are carrying flags, and they are horizontally striped from top to bottom in yellow, red, and blue. The caption reads, "A celebration on January 3 in Santiago, Chile. South American nations have taken in millions of Venezuelans." And the final photograph, this is a more dreary-looking day. I'll read the caption first. "Federal agents escort Maduro and his wife en route to a federal courtroom in New York, January 5. There are three individuals dressed in what appear to be uniforms, somewhat military or police-looking. Two are wearing khakis and caps, and the third is wearing dark blue slacks and a jacket. All three of these people have DEA written on their jackets. And then the Maduro and his wife, Flores, I believe, are also dressed in kind of khaki clothing. They're ill-fitting slacks and a really big jacket, especially for her. He is standing tall. He has dark hair and dark facial hair. She is a shorter, and by the way, he's flanked by two of the DEA professionals, and she is being held, almost being held up, it looks like, that is supported by a DEA official, and she looks like she has grayish blonde hair. Now I'm going to give credit to the photographers for these various images. The man standing by the rubble, photographer by Jesus Vargas, Getty Images. The crowd in Santiago, Chile. The photograph is by Cristobal Olivares, Bloomberg, Getty Images. The motorcycles racing through the street with armed men riding them. Not necessarily the drivers are armed. Photograph again by Jesus Vargas, Getty Images. And the one featuring the DEA officers and the Maduros, photograph by XNY Starmax GC Images. This article says, "The Brief Health, Five Things Not to Say to Someone with ADHD" by Angela Haupt. Now, I'm abbreviating this, and I'm going to tell you the five things. Are you sure you have ADHD? You don't look like it. Don't say that to a person with ADHD. Everybody struggles with that. You are way too dramatic. You have so much potential if you would just try harder. Can you stop fidgeting for 1 minute? We'll save you the trouble of wondering. Yes, people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, have considered using planners, setting alarm clocks, and creating reminders on the phones. No, those suggestions are not helpful. In fact, these are among the worst things you can say to someone with ADHD, which is characterized by symptoms like having a hard time paying attention, struggling with task initiation, and engaging in impulsive behavior. It's like, wow, what a genius idea, says Bailey Pilant, a licensed mental health counselor in New York who specializes in ADHD. Yet people dispense these well-intentioned but unsolicited tips again and again, including telling Pilant she should try writing things down. I can write it down, and I'm still not going to remember because you can bet I'm going to lose the paper, she says. I'm not going to remember I wrote it down. I'm not going to remember where I wrote it down. I'm not going to be able to find it. And then just like that, it's out of my head. Instead, Pilant suggests offering support with comments like these. I can see how much effort it takes you to manage this. It sounds really hard. You could also show interest by asking, what are the biggest challenges you deal with every day? And the remarks that began this little article are from experts, and they're considered infuriating and should be avoided. And that article was abbreviated because we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us, 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.